Okay, I'm going to not, let's see. I am going to record this. I'm starting to record now. And unlike last time when I simply forgot, got busy and forgot to turn on the recorder. If people need a recording of the one last time, I suggest that they look at last year's, I'm sorry, 2 years ago, the website, which there's a link to on the, our website. You can find my recordings of what I said then, which I, you know, I'm unimaginative and I don't change what I say very much. So it will be similar. It might overlap between a couple of lectures, but other than that, it will be fine. I'm not handing back the homework. Homework number 4 this time because I'm not quite finished grading it. You're all doing pretty well, but I still need to finish that. And I will be handing out a new homework maybe today, maybe most likely tomorrow. We were going over the equilibrium between mutation and selection, and I got onto the subject of genetic load, which I'll come back to in a second. And I'm going to show you a few slides that went with what I talked about before. They're back there. Let's see if we can control them. This is a mouse that might be able to watch the cords. Might be able to reach to the end of the room. Let's see. No. There. Okay. Let me make it dark for a moment. My laser pointer might work too. This was the approach to mutational equilibrium that we talked about, where, you know, the departure from equilibrium every generation is multiplied by 1 minus, this is in a 2 allele case, 1 minus the sum of the forward and backward mutation rates. And here you see it approaching an equilibrium. And in this case, which mutation rates are 1, this is from the book, 10 to the minus 7 and 5 times that amount. 5 times that amount being towards little a. And the equilibrium is at 1/6. And you approach it on its, and you can see on the time scale here to get halfway there, well, that would be about, say if you started at 0, getting halfway there would be about 6 million generations. Likewise, if you start up here, getting halfway there is about here, and again it's about the same. And if you start from any other point, it's also true with this kind of math that halfway there then is still that same number of generations. That was a simple mutational equilibrium. And then we were talking about mutation versus selection, and I gave you the formula for a recessive gene, which would be square root of the ratio between the mutation rate and the selection coefficient. I'll write it up here, but the equilibrium frequency, square root of mu over s, we're calling it. And that's the recessive case. And then when you have partial dominance, the equilibrium is the mutation rate over the selection against the heterozygote, h times s. Well, on that graph, you see a case where what I've done is to take a case where I believe it's a case where there's forward but not backward mutation. But we're, instead of doing the approximation that I gave you, this U over HS, it's being done exactly. That requires a quadratic equation, solution of a quadratic equation. If I throw in addition to doing it exactly, if I throw in back mutation as well, then it becomes a cubic equation. And yes, you can solve it, but it's painful. You can solve it numerically, certainly. So what you see here is a case where I'm trying different degrees of dominance. So we have the same selection I think it's 1% against the, let me find that, against the homozygote group. Oh, I have it right here somewhere. There we go. Yeah, 1% selection
in against little a. And then we try various degrees of dominance. So a degree of dominance of 10 to the minus 2 is 1% of that. So the selection against the heterozygote would be 1 part in 10,000. So what you see is for different degrees of dominance, when H is very, very, very small, essentially everything is recessive. There's so little selection against the heterozygote that it doesn't have much effect. And this horizontal dotted line is the pure recessive case. So it would be equivalent to, it's the limit at H equals 0. That's the, these are log-log scales, and that gives you, and it just doesn't depend on H because H is too, when H gets too small. Likewise, this one here is inversely proportional to H. That's the U over HS. That's where the selection is effectively occurring entirely in heterozygotes in the limit. A little bit of selection occurs against the homozygote, but they're pretty rare. And you can see that that's this dotted line, and here the solid curve is the solution to the quadratic equation. And basically it goes from the one to the other. It's interesting where it makes the transition. It makes the transition, well, makes the transition right at the point where the two approximations are equal to each other. It's basically a hyperbola, or looks something very close to being a hyperbola. And you can see, therefore, that even a modest amount of selection against the heterozygote is enough that because the heterozygotes are so much more frequent, I don't like that flickering, they're so much more frequent than homozygotes. The selection in the heterozygote is killing many more copies of the little a deleterious allele than the selection against the homozygote. And you can see the transition between those two. I even give a table in the book of that. Okay. So then we get to genetic load. And I showed you the approximation for the recessive. It isn't actually an approximation. In a case where there's no back mutation, it's exact. The load is, let me put a little bit of light up here. The load is... in the recessive case, simply equal to the mutation rate. That's the reduction in fitness at a single locus that is recessive and has a deleterious allele at equilibrium between selection and mutation. And this is exact if you don't have back mutation. It's a very, very good approximation. Otherwise, in the partial dominance case, it works out, I was showing you at the end, that the load is twice that. And we'll give you in a moment a good feel for why that difference. Here you can see, this is again with forward mutation. It's the same combination of cases. It's forward mutation with selection 1% against the homozygote, and different values of H again. And here's this transition between the two approximations. And you'll see when H is small enough that the heterozygote is effectively not being selected, the load is equal to the mutation rate, which in this case is 10 to the minus 7. And when you go through the transition, then it becomes double that. Okay, so... Now there's a good intuitive way of making the load calculation even simpler. It's approximate, and let me show it to you up here. And let me see, just a sec. I wanted to see. Yeah, I'll come back to that. Of the load, I'll just say the load I told you was discovered by J.B.S. Haldane and by this guy H.J. Muller, who is. Muller, I'm not sure I told you. Did I tell you about Muller? I don't think I did. H.J. Muller was a member of Thomas Hunt Morgan's famous fly lab at Columbia University in the 1910s. And he was, interestingly enough, Julian Huxley from England, who had got a very eminent zoologist, became Sir Julian Huxley, passed through in 1913. He passed through the Mueller Fly Lab, and he was on his way to what's now Rice University in Houston. It was called Rice Institute then, where he was going to be head of the biology department. He was only head of it for a couple of years, and then World War I came, and he went back to England. But on his way, he went through the fly lab, talked to them all about what they were doing, the famous laboratory of the founding, really, of Drosophila genetics. And he identifies one guy and said to him, why don't I hire you to come at Rice University, at Rice Institute? And that was H.J. Mueller. And he had picked himself a future Nobel Prize winner. Mueller went to Rice University. Huxley had gone, by the time he got there, he overlapped with Huxley only briefly. Huxley went back to England. Mueller went on to have a complex career involving going to the Soviet Union for a while in the 1930s, discovering that the Soviet Union was not so great, leaving. And ending up back in the U.S., where he then was under a political cloud because of his association with the Soviet Union. In the 1920s, what he had done, he was really the greatest classical geneticist. He had worked out a system of inversions on Drosophila chromosomes that could be used to accurately detect lethal alleles. And so he could... by looking at the way the inversion segregated, he could take a chromosome from the wild, or a chromosome that had been subject to a treatment, and basically get it into both males and females, heterozygous over Drosophila inversions on that chromosome that contained markers, and then do a cross such that one of the four classes that emerged was the homozygote for the same chromosome. And if that class disappeared, then there was if there weren't any members of that class, that was the indication that there was a lethal allele. Using that technology, he was able to prove in the 1920s, in about 1927, 27 to 29, that radiation in fact induced mutations. And that had been suspected by people, but they didn't know how to prove it. And he came up with this very precise way of detecting the occurrence of lethals and showing that if you irradiated flies, you got more lethal, more lethal mutations in the flies. He became a great expert on mutations. He received, the end of World War II, his academic career was... very rocky. Universities were hesitant to hire him until that year he won the Nobel Prize for his discovery that radiation induced mutations. And he then went on to be, he ended up at Indiana University. He was at first the University of Texas and then Indiana University, where he stayed for the rest of their career. His career, I think he died in 1966 or 7. He was the great expert in mutation, and he got involved in a lot of the arguing about atomic bomb testing above ground, creating mutations, creating radiation in the atmosphere, and what effects that would have. Okay, that was Mueller. Mueller in 1950 was one of the co-inventors, co-discoverers of the mutational load. Not the mutational load, he did that too. Yeah, of the mutational load, I'm sorry. Addle-headed here. He basically discovered this math. So it turned out that J.B.S. Haldane had also discovered it in 1939. I think Mueller wasn't aware of that. Okay, so you have this. There is a much simpler way of making this load calculation. And that is to say, well, waving our hands, let's imagine that mutations are occurring. They float around in the population for a while. And then finally, they're eliminated by selection against them. And as I believe you showed last time, you argued last time, even a mildly deleterious mutation is ultimately eliminated. So in a sense, every mutation that occurs corresponds to, there's a corresponding selective death. If we look at the partial dominant case for the moment, the number of mutations coming into a population, if the population is size n, which we're going to assume is big, we're not worried about genetic drift here, we're just going to do a deterministic calculation, then there are 2n copies of the gene. And you can say, well, to good approximation, the number of mutations that will occur in an average generation is equal to, there's a chance, mu, whatever letter you're using, of having each copy mutate, so the number of mutations you expect is about this. Now, you can immediately see that that's an approximation, because we haven't taken into account that some of them already are mutations. So it's not quite exact, but as long as the rate of mutations is small enough that the frequency of mutations is small, that's not too bad. And that should be approximately balanced in each generation by the number of copies killed off by selection against those mutations. Now, if this is a partial dominance case, for each such selective death, I mean, there are many reasons why individuals can die, but we're talking about the deaths due to carrying a deleterious allele. For each selective death, how many copies of the mutation will be eliminated? Anybody want to hazard a guess? A typical selective death will carry with it how many copies of the mutant? In at the single locus that we're talking about.
One.
Yeah, because these are heterozygotes.
Okay.
So if the fraction of individuals in the population that die is from this genetic death is L, the mutational load, there are N individuals in the population, the number of individuals killed by this mutational load, or sterilized, will be N times L. Each will take with it one copy of the allele. So at equilibrium, when there's an equilibrium between mutations coming in and the load killing them off, this will be true. And then, of course, you just cancel out the N. And there you are, without doing any gene frequencies or anything. The mutational load is twice the mutation rate. We can do the same thing for the homozygous recessive, where there are 2NU mutations come in. Each death now kills how many copies?
Two.
Two. So it's the number of copies killed. So this is copies mutated or killed by the mutational load, so it's those supposed to be equal to each other. So it'll be 2n times the fraction of, it'll be the number of individuals being killed is n times l, and each takes with them two alleles. And then you cancel out the twos and the n's, and again, without doing any gene frequencies at all, you get that the mutational load is equal to the mutation rate. I switched the two sides, but that's it. So it's really just a simple consequence of the fact that there's a balance between deleterious mutations coming in and those being eliminated by the death or sterility of affected heterozygotes or homozygotes. By the way, I can do a similar calculation, an almost as easy calculation to get these equilibrium frequencies and the gene frequency, and you'll see that in the notes. But, of course, the fuller math is there, too. Okay, so that's the mutational load. And the question arises, what is the mutational load in typical organism? Let's take ourselves, which we're not completely typical. But mutation rates per, the mutation rate per base in the genome is approximately, I'll say 10 to the minus 8. Let's try 10 to the minus 8 and see if that works. It's a little, I think a little lower than that. It's more than 10 to the minus 9. So it's somewhere between 10 to the minus 9 and 10 to the minus 8. Now, the question comes up is, how many positions are there in the genome, how many bases are there in the genome that are carrying information? And each of those is then subject to deleterious mutations. Well, let's try to make a rough calculation. Let's say there are, we believe there are around 20,000 loci. Now, each locus, and if those, most of those loci are coding for proteins, these are protein coding loci. So I'm going to do a mutational load calculation for those. A typical length of a protein might be around 500 amino acids. Three times that, remember these are codons, is 1,500. So it'll be times 1,500 bases. Now we're leaving out here bases upstream that may be control regions of one sort or another, or downstream, or perhaps in the introns. So it'll be a little bit bigger than this, but let's take this and take a look. Well, this is the number of bases is 30 million? Let me see if I, 30 million, so 3 times 10 to the 7 bases that are doing something, in this case, coding for protein. I'm leaving out possibly some other thing, you know, some other places in the genome where there are things like RNAs in this calculation. Now we can say, for each of those bases, there is a mutational load. So mutational load is about 10 to the minus 8. Well, twice 10 to the minus 8. Let's assume that partial dominant case is the relevant one. And then there's the question, how do you combine the load at different loci? Well, the mean fitness at one locus, let's see, let's do it this way. Let's do 1,500, instead of using this product, 1,500 bases per locus times 10 to the minus 8. So it will be 1.5 times 10 to the minus 5. Somebody correct me if I got that, if I get the wrong number. That's the mutational load per locus. Sorry, it's the load, and the mean fitness is not that, it is 1 minus that. So the fitness at each locus is being reduced in the vicinity of 1.5 times 10 to the minus 5. And that isn't very much, but there's a lot of loci. And the relevant way of combining these is probably to take the product of these over loci. So for each locus, the fitness is reduced by from 1 down to 1 minus 1.5 times 10 to the minus 5. And although you could add up those reductions in fitness, it seems that the more relevant way of combining them is to take the products of these mean fitnesses to say, in effect, that if you're an individual, you might or might not survive based on your genotype at this locus. You might or might not survive based on your genotype at another locus and another and another. The probability of surviving all of those is basically the product of the probability of surviving each of them. And if you do that, then that's 1 minus 1.5 times 10 to the minus 5 raised to the 20,000th power. And that can be approximated very well by saying this thing in brackets is very nearly e to the minus 1.5 times 10 to the minus 5. E to this minus this little number to the 20,000. And that will be e to the minus, boom, 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 that's 30 times, I think it's 0.3, but let me just, is it 0.3 or 0.03? I'll have to do it carefully. 2 times 10 to the 4 times 1.5 times 10 to the minus 5 equals 3 times 10 to the minus 1 or 0.3. So it's e to the minus 0.3. Now what that means is basically fitness is being decreased by 30%. Well, by e to the minus 0.3. I'll do the calculation for the e to the minus just to be meticulous about it. And it is... Okay, point e to the minus 0.3, 0.7408. So 0.7408. So a 26% reduction in fitness, not quite 30% because of this multiplying factor. So what you can see is that the mutational load at any one locus is not so great, but there's a lot of loci. Multiplying it all up and taking into account multiplying the W bars and approximating by E, get about a 26%. You can also do this calculation here more exactly if you want. It'll come out very close to that. So the 26% reduction in fitness, and that's pretty big.
I feel really silly asking this. When you say a 26% reduction in fitness...
Compared to a population where nobody has any mutations.
Okay.
A deletereous mutation.
So, like,
that's the comparison.
Got it.
I mean, you can have all sorts of other reasons why individuals might get, eaten by hawks or run over by trucks or, whatever, that have nothing to do with their genotype. So you can see a sort of substantial genetic load would exist. Now, I was doing this with figures from humans. In industrial society, the probability of an individual surviving into their years of reproduction, the probability of dying before you get to the years of reproduction is very small. It's in the order of a few percent, 1%, 2%. So you might say, well, then we don't see any reduction in fitness. But you have to also take into account not just survival, but reproductive sterility, infertility of one sort or another. That's another way that deleterious mutations could have an effect on fitness. The other possibility is to say we're not at equilibrium, that because of advances in our human survival, we're surviving better than we would if we were at equilibrium with the mutation rate. And the mutation rates are, in fact, continuing then to pump in deleterious mutations that aren't all being eliminated. For your homework, you're basically doing a calculation like that. Now, the other side of this calculation is, it's fine. And it looks like, well, that might be somewhere near what the 26% might be somewhere near what the mutational load, how much the mutational load reduced fitness in an organism that was in a state of nature at equilibrium between mutation and selection. So, maybe not ourselves, but maybe wild mice or something like that. Deer mice, for example. It's okay. It's borderline, except there's a problem. And the problem was noticed in the 1960s when people started to have, as a result of the work in the 1950s around the time of the discovery of the structure of DNA, the DNA content of cells was being analyzed, and there came to be known what was called the C paradox. And the C paradox was basically that C was the letter that happened to be being used for the DNA content, I think it comes from content, of cells. And it was found that the DNA content of cells was much, much bigger than 3 × 10⁷ bases. Of course, we now know that it's actually somewhere near 3 × 10⁹ bases. We're all taught that figure. I'm told it's just dropped below that figure a little bit, but 2.9 maybe instead of 3. That means there was, for this calculation, there's 100 times too much DNA. And so that was considered a big puzzle. Some people took refuge in estimates of the number of loci that were in the vicinity of 100,000. We now know the number is closer to 20,000, but actually even early on, people didn't really believe the 100,000 theory. There, you'll see this, it cited repeatedly that people used to think there were 100,000 loci. When I was training in, I got that figure, and so I believed it for many years, but apparently the people who really knew what they were doing didn't, and thought that the number of loci was more like 30,000. Turned out to be 20,000. They weren't way off. In 1969 to 1972, a number of people, including, in terms of the publicizing it, the most effective publicizing guy who publicized it was Susumu Ono, then in, San Diego. And Ono basically, around that time, popularized the notion of junk DNA. He said, well, look, from this and a couple of other lines of evidence, we can conclude that most of the genome of eukaryotes consists of what he called junk DNA, which was the basically DNA that isn't doing anything. It's sitting around in the genome. It's in between the genes, or now we know possibly some of the sites in the introns, and that mutation of that DNA is not causing a genetic load. It will simply flip the base, but it won't actually change anything phenotypically. And so in the 1970s, reluctantly, evolutionary biologists and molecular evolutionists began to accept the idea that most of the genome is junk DNA. There were a couple of other lines of evidence besides the mutational load argument. Ono did use the mutational load argument. He said, if all that DNA is doing something, the amount, the number of times it would mutate is so high that we'd be dead many times over, basically. Or another way of putting it is, if it tried to evolve to have all that DNA do something, it would never get there because there'd be too much mutation pushing back. So the junk DNA argument was greatly strengthened by the mutational load calculations. But there really is, so the mutational load was one line of evidence, but there's at least a couple of others. One of them was that when we annotate the genomes in eukaryotes, we find a lot of things like transposons, transposable elements. They weren't, back in 1969 to 72, they weren't known. They were just, the first hints of them were beginning to emerge. It really wasn't until the 1980s that people began to realize that a lot of the genome could be annotated as dead copies of transposons and other various kinds of junk DNA elements that seemed to be selfish elements that were propagating themselves in the genome, and most of the copies we have are dead selfish elements. They're not continuing to propagate themselves. But you could annotate. I think it's for the human genome. It's around half of it can be seen to be transposons or dead, mostly dead transposons layered over each other. But there's an additional piece of information, and that is changes of genome size. Because if you look at us, you see a genome of 3 times 10 to the 9 bases. But if you look around among, for example, vertebrates, you see a lot of variation in DNA content, and some of them have many more bases than we do. The champion among tetrapods, among land animals, is are salamanders, some of which have genomes that are about 20 times larger than our genome. Now, if you want to argue that a salamander is such a sophisticated organism that it needs 20 times as many genes as we do, well, go ahead and argue that. But I don't think you'll find very many people buying that argument. Yeah?
What's the ploidy of the salamander?
Ploidy, well, it depends on how recent a ploidy you want to talk about. I mean, they have duplicates. I don't know the answer. The short answer is I don't know offhand. But I believe that salamanders, I think, are diploid, but they can be seen to have had some ploidy events. In addition, if you look among all vertebrates, the champion is actually lungfish. Lungfish have something like 33 times as much DNA as we do. So if you want to argue that all that DNA is really doing something, that it can all be annotated as genes, control elements, et cetera, it's all needed, it's all important, you're going to have to explain why we are so inferior in our genome to salamanders and to lungfish. In addition, I believe one of the champions among plants are onions. Different species of onions have much more DNA than we do, but they also have much different DNA from each other. Some species of onions have much more DNA than other species of onions. And I'll tell you, I'm headed towards the junk DNA controversy of a few years ago when the onion comes in as a symbol in this argument. Okay, you just had your hand up again.
So you're sort of arguing that the size of the genome isn't correlated with complexity?
Well, complex phenotypic complexity or adaptively important phenotypic complexity. I argue no, it is not. Well, that leads us right on to the recent controversy, because this was all understood from about 1972 on. And everything was fine until the year 2012. And in the year 2012, the ENCODE consortium, which was annotating the human genome with 400 researchers annotating the human genome for control elements, RNA transcription, and many other interesting things, completed its work. They published a paper in 2012. And they found transcription factor binding sites scattered out in the areas of the genome that were thought to be junk DNA, and they found RNA transcription at low levels pervasive throughout the whole human genome. And they then gave a press conference. From my point of view, it was a disastrous press conference. They had reporting on wonderful work. They got up there and they said, we can now see that there isn't any such thing as junk DNA, that all that DNA out in between the genes is doing something, because look, there are transcription factor binding sites out there, there's RNA transcription going on for large parts of the genome. The figure that they gave was that 80% of the human genome was, quote, functional. Now, when pressed on the issue of what they meant by functional, it really was, well, we can see transcription factor binding sites, and we can see RNA transcription there. And we call that functionality. Many molecular biologists responded very positively to this and said, ah, look, we always thought that the human genome or any eukaryotic genome was this finely tuned machine in which every part played a role and every part was doing something important. And besides, I lampoon this a little bit, I'm a little biased in what I'm going to say. And besides, if this is true, think of all the grants we can apply for to work out what all that DNA is doing. Just think of it. They have since adjusted the figure down to 40%. By the way, creationists rejoiced and said, we always knew that this was true. We all, you know, our theology suggested to us that the genome is perfectly designed and things like junk DNA are not, were repellent to them, and they were very happy, and they immediately cited all this. The popular science press jumped on this bandwagon. Let me show you to what extent. Here, now I don't know that you can see it, so let me turn this off. Okay, now you probably see. Here, there's a guy, Ryan Gregory, who has a blog called Genomicron. He's at, I think, McMaster University in Hamilton, Ontario. And he collected together the responses. Now, keep in mind that what these science reporters are doing is accurately reporting what the press conference said. This is not a fantasy that they made up. It is a fantasy, from my point of view, a fantasy that the ENCODE, the leaders in the ENCODE consortium made up and announced. So, New York Times, bits of mystery DNA far from junk play crucial role. Well, that's ambiguous. Los Angeles Times, ENCODE product sheds light, etc. Washington Post, junk DNA concept debunked. Wall Street Journal, junk DNA debunked. USA Today, junk DNA plays major role in disease. This is Scientific American, hidden treasures in junk DNA. Breakthroughs, the Guardian in Britain, the great breakthrough study overturns theory of junk DNA in the genome. The Independent in Britain, junk DNA theory, scientists debunk junk DNA theory. Here they even had scientists cracking the junk DNA code. Nobody really knows what a code is, or, you know, your DNA code is either that code table or it's the exact sequence of your DNA, depending on who's writing the article. The new world of DNA, how active our junk DNA is, solve junk DNA, Globe and Mail in Toronto. There was a huge wave of science, of popular science reports saying, in effect, bye-bye junk DNA. There is no junk DNA. All these people from 1969-72 onward who thought that there was junk DNA were fooled. They were wrong. No more junk DNA. Well, molecular evolutionists reacted with fury, all of them as far as I know, because they knew there were these lines of evidence. What about the mutational load? Hey, folks, why are so many of them annotatable as selfish DNA, and what about those changes of size in the genome? If we need all that DNA, why are some strains of onions immeasurably more complicated biologically than other strains of onions? Why are lungfish and salamanders our superiors in sophisticated biology? Yes?
Do you know about the recombination rates in the lungfish and salamanders?
Short answer, no, and I'm not going to talk about it.
Okay.
For example, the Society of Molecular Biology and Evolution meetings, Nick Matsky was one of the people arguing for the idea that junk DNA. He made up a T-shirt that he sold to people that said, keep calm and talk about onions, and it had a picture of an onion. And to my mind, you know, I've given you a very partisan account. You can go out to John Stamatianopoulos in our own department, who was part of the ENCODE consortium and was very public and has been very public about his support for the idea that all that stuff is doing something, and get the other side of the story. Yeah.
So you can say, you can just shoot this down, but my next thought was, like, onions might be that complex, because instead of, like, everything is doing something positive, there's a large part of the genome that is just negating another large part of the genome. Is that, like, at all a reasonable argument?
You could make an argument like that. You would still have to deal with the other two parts of the lines of evidence in that, and you'd have to explain why we can all survive at all in the face of our known mutation rates. Yeah.
So transposons all over the genome. Wouldn't you expect to see transcription and promoters scattered throughout?
Yeah.
So, I mean,
well, wait, you would expect under which hypothesis?
The junk DNA hypothesis.
Well, like that's what people have argued. They said, in effect, yes, random changes in DNA will create transcription factor binding sites, so there'll be some junk transcription factor binding sites, and they will create some junk transcription. So the argument has, you know, gone back and forth a bit on that. They're arguing against that kind of evidence on that basis. So the fight is still raging. I would say, from my point of view, where I think really the genome does have a lot of junk, that in 2012 the ENCODE consortium set back popular understanding of science, not just popular understanding of science, but understanding of science by many biological scientists by at least 10 years. It's going to take us 10 years to get back to the point where everybody says, yeah, well, I guess there is junk DNA there. So this has been a very partisan picture. But it's where the mutational load argument plays a very important, one of the central roles in the argument. And if you could want those salamanders to be, if we want to be in awe of our superior, the onion, or our superior, the salamander, or the lungfish, you're still going to have to talk your way out of the mutational load.
Isn't that why we have redundancy in our regulatory networks, and why we have two chromosomes instead of one? Because the chance of both of them getting knocked out is, you know, much smaller than one. I mean, isn't that the whole point of?
Well,
you can have a larger chromosome if you have redundancy.
There is a good argument for having redundancy in the face of developmental and environmental noise. In the face of mutational noise, you have to consider the fact that the mutations, if they're buffered against, will rise to higher frequencies at equilibrium. And so if there is recessiveness, the mutations rise to a higher gene frequency. And what's relevant is not the frequencies of the mutations that you get, but the level of mutational load. Now, it is true that, let's see, a haploid will be like a recessive. A diploid with partial dominance will actually have a higher mutational load because it has more genes to mutate. There's more copies to mutate, which is what's going on there.
Recombination, anti-Behrit. Does that make sense?
I'm not going to answer that.
Okay.
Besides, we're out of time. That gives me an excuse for not answering that. So anyway, you've heard my rant and rave on the subject of MPN. Where we're headed, we're now about three lectures behind our schedule, so I don't know how I'm going to recover from that. But where we're headed is to talk about migration for a couple of lectures in the next chunk, and then it's on to inbreeding, and that's put in there to get us able to deal with genetic drift, which is the next major topic after migration.